Okay, hi everyone, welcome back. I'm Rachel Ford, Jennifer McIntyre, and we're both attorneys at the Snohomish County Public Defender's Office. Most of you guys look like you've been here the other two nights. We wanted to start out tonight just recapping where we are, or where we've been the last couple days. The first night we talked about alternatives to incarceration and what we could do in our communities to promote those and the positive effects that they would have, not just for the people who are accused or convicted of crimes, but also for our community as a whole. And last night
we talked about bail reform and how to keep people who are poor from being held while they're still presumed innocent. And also the racism in the bail structure and how that can be addressed also.
So tonight we're going to do, we went to Anthony's session this morning. He said, what you do is, you know, you push people and then you do it a little bit more. And so that's what we're doing tonight. And tonight we are going to be talking about sex offenders and reintegrating them back into our communities. And we know that many people have been victims of these terrible crimes and been extremely hurt by them. And so this is not a presentation that seeks to justify or excuse that behavior in any way, but really focuses on change, the capacity for change, and what we can do as a community to encourage that change, support that change, and keep us and the former offenders safer when they do come back into our communities.
We feel like this really does resonate with some of the talks we've seen this week about the other and about borders. There's really no bigger border than a prison wall in a lot of ways. And with sex offenders especially, there's really no other group that we really want to distance from, not engage with, kind of deny that they're out there in a lot of ways. And I think that's a perfectly natural reaction to keep your family safe, to keep you safe, and to have that reaction when you find out somebody's a sex offender or there's a sex offender in your community. But really, everything we've talked about up until tonight is a little bit of low-hanging fruit. A lot of people want to keep the mentally ill out of jail. A lot of people want to keep drug addicts, you know, out of jail and find alternatives. You know, everybody is on board that, well, not everybody, I'm sure this community, though, is on board that racism is a huge problem in the criminal justice system. But tonight, we're really digging a little deeper and saying, you know, what as Christians do we do with people who are vilified, you know, the outcasts of our society in a really serious way?
I think that's why we that sort of inspired the name of our presentation for tonight, not to at all say that lepers did anything to earn their leprosy, and that's not the case with at least the sex offenders we're going to be talking about tonight. They certainly did things to earn their status. I think what the idea was, though, is that, you know, people were so fearful about having lepers reintegrate into their community and thought that if they let them in, you know, it would just basically corrupt all of their communities. And so what we hope to do is discuss sort of some of, you know, what's reality about that and maybe what's not founded in reality and actual data.
Just for some background, Rachel and I have both worked many years with a population that's called sexually violent predators. In Washington State, it's under a law, 7109, it's called, that after someone is finished with their criminal sentence, the state can then commit them indefinitely, and they go to an island, McNeil Island, and they just stay there until it can be shown that they can come back into society. So we've both worked with this population quite a bit. So that's kind of where we're coming from with this program. To start it off, we're going to show you a video. It's about 8 minutes long. It's not a video we made. It's a video that HBO contacted our office and said, would a couple of your clients who are on McNeil Island talk to us? And we were really worried about it because we want to protect our clients. But these clients wanted to talk, and so we arranged for them to meet with the HBO producers, and I don't know if anybody knows Vice, it's an HBO show. They put together this segment. These are one client in here. Bruce, is that what he was like in this video too? Did you change his name? Or Justin?
Justin yeah. went by Justin. Yes.
Is a client of Rachel's, and Brent, he goes by a different name in this video, is a client of mine. And they both have, since this video, have been released into the community, so we wanted to be able to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, and I just, as you're watching this, you know, keep in mind, like, examine what your reactions are. I think Jennifer's client comes across better than my client does, but they are both sort of subject to the same program and have really had very good success with it. But you know, there's some things that we just kind of react to emotionally, and you might find that you're experiencing that. Interestingly, just before we get to the video, Holden has had a very strange connection to all of this week. This is my first time here, but Jennifer's been coming here for years. One of our colleagues, Sonia Hardenbrook, has been coming to Holden for years, and she also works with this population. It's very specialized. And then we learned that another colleague who does not work out of our office, but there's only about 27 attorneys in the whole state that represent these clients. And Paul Bankin, you're the Bankins, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, the son of the Bankins also work in...
At this time, they change.
Yeah, and he works, we know him well. He represents also people very similar to the ones you're going to see. And then Pastor Mark came up to me right before this, and he said, "Oh, I think my dad knows you." And I couldn't quite put it together, and his dad is Judge Lorman.
Yeah.
Judge Lorman... presided over the trial for Justin, who you will see in this video, and Judge Lorman actually I think it was in February, signed the order for his release. So it's a very, very interesting connection. Yeah. Okay, so without further ado.
This is the only way onto and off the island. Yeah.
This runs every 2 hours, both ways.
This island is where Washington State sends its worst and most dangerous sex offenders. They are deemed sexually violent predators, whose crimes and personality disorders are considered so extreme that they need to be separated from society. Bill Van Hook has been in charge here for almost 2 years.
So this is our central control room. It's where all the security operations are centralized and monitored.
And do people try and escape?
Pretty rarely. We haven't had anybody attempted in years. Nothing should really happen.
Well, this certainly looks like a prison. Legally, it's a treatment center. But all 236 residents were sent here against their will, despite having already served their prison sentences elsewhere. And when they arrive, none of them have a release date.
We are the first civil confinement facility for sexually violent predators in the United States. It was established in 1991. People who have served their prison sentence are evaluated at the end of their sentence, and if they're evaluated to present a high risk of reoffending, they're referred to prosecution to have them committed for treatment at our facility.
Forced confinement facilities like this are legal for people with mental abnormalities who are considered high risk, and only if treatment is offered. And if there is a chance of release. 19 other states have similar programs, and in 1997, the Supreme Court ruled that they were legal.
There's nobody here who walked in here and said, "Please pick me for civil commitment." And the way that they're now seeing, the way the league is, I've got to get involved in treatment, and that's how I'm with them.
That's the only way they're going to do it.
Well, they can go out by dying, which is not the preferred way, obviously. They can go out if they become so old and disabled that they no longer need.
Justin, who asked that we only use his first name, began molesting children when he was a child himself. He was convicted at age 13 of first-degree child rape for molesting his half-sister for over a year. He spent 5 years in prison and 10 more years here on McNeil Island.
I'm going to go to my room now, and I'm going to put my briefcase away, so...
And the briefcase and the suit, is that for us, or is that for your attorney?
I always like to dress appropriately, so, yeah. I'm very festive. I like decorating.
Like many sex offenders, Justin was himself abused. He was also diagnosed with ADHD and antisocial personality disorder.
And I'm both a victim of a sexual assault and a physical assault. And I will tell you that it took forever for me to forgive myself for what I've done. I got my siblings, you know, who I victimized, and it's like, you know what? I have something to prove to them. I need to leave them a legacy and say, hey, you know what? Justin is not this bad person anymore.
So the predominant modality of treatment here is group therapy, but we also offer something called case management, which is up to an hour of individual therapy a month for each resident.
Elena Lopez is in charge of the treatment program, which aims to manage residents' compulsion to the point where they are no longer likely to reoffend.
This visual depiction helps them understand that certain things come from within inside ourselves and certain things are external to us that we still need to be mindful of.
So the aim is to manage their aversion instincts rather than get rid of them?
Absolutely. So the purpose of our treatment program is to manage their risk. It's not to eradicate or eliminate or get rid of, because most of our residents may always have a proclivity for deviance in some way, whether that's for children or non-consensual sex or other.
Justin, who has spent 19 years of his life incarcerated, eventually engaged with the treatment program and is now convinced he will not commit sex offences again.
And you know, given the crimes you did commit, do you think you were born capable of committing those crimes?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
So what do you think now? You know, made you capable of doing this thing?
I would beg to ask the question, what led up to, you know, being in an environment where I felt hurt, where I felt angry, where I felt rejected.
But those are fairly common feelings for people to feel. You could feel those things again.
Of course I could, but now I have different ways of dealing with them. Yeah?
So you're managing your desires, your emotions, your reactions to your situations. Does that mean you still have desires about children?
No, I don't. I don't. It's just, it's a weird thing. I mean, I don't have any urges towards children. I don't have any struggles about urges towards children. And I mean, I honestly, I'm baffled. You know, because it's like, I just stopped thinking about it.
Whatever it was that worked, Justin has now convinced the state that he should be released. He's scheduled to get out later this year, with major restrictions and monitoring. Rachel Ford has represented Justin for 5 years. What benefit does that actually offer?
No benefit at all. I mean, the treatment is better on the outside. The opportunities to reintegrate into society are better on the outside, so there's no purpose. If our society gets together and says, we want life sentences for all sex offenders, then we should just be honest about that and say that and change our laws.
Good treatment has been proven to reduce reoffending rates. The 30 states deal with sex offenders without places like McNeil Island. There are no studies that show civil commitment is much more effective than community treatment. Wayne, who also asked that we only use a single name, repeatedly sexually assaulted young children and was convicted of child molestation and statutory rape. But after 13 years on the island, he's now been released unconditionally and is studying to be a social worker.
Are you still a paedophile today?
I don't see myself as a paedophile today.
You were convicted for multiple offences against children.
Yes.
Are you saying that at the time you had no idea what you were doing was wrong?
I always knew it was wrong, okay? But my desire for wanting a form of intimacy and love, even though I learned later that's not what it was, but growing up in the abused background, I had a lot of conflict of messages, which are lies we tell ourselves to justify our actions or our behaviors, and I thought it was the truth, that what I was doing was out of love.
You're definitely no longer a risk.
I feel that there's always potential for a risk based on what a person has done in their past. okay? But it's what we do to eliminate those risks. I don't come down here normally and hang out at a park when I know there's kids around down here. This is a park that gets frequent during the summer because I don't even want the appearance. You know, the reality is people can change.
Even if serial child molesters can change, it will take a lot to convince the public that they are anything but monsters.
Do you think this will exist in, say, 5 years' time?
It'll be here for longer than that.
And do you think there's, you know, that'll ever be the political will to close it?
I don't know. It would be a tough sell.
Okay, so I guess we'd just like to open it up to people's thoughts about this. Basically, many of us feel fearful when we think about people, serial child molesters, as they're described in here, coming back into our society. So let's talk about our fears. What fears do we have? Go ahead.
That psychologists, psychiatrists, and people of that ilk have not done enough studies, proper homework, to be able to rationally judge the chance for reoffending.
Okay, so we don't have very good
measures.
I know.
Yeah,
sure. Okay, anyone else? Other fears? Yep, go ahead.
Well, we had four daughters and took them to church and were told to, you know, to love all people. And the chance that them walking to school by themselves and being approached by somebody that they wouldn't, you know, be able to protect themselves if something happened.
So being approached by a stranger and
right.
Not being able to protect
and,
them.
You know, you teach them, you know, don't talk to strangers.
Mm-hmm.
People are very persuasive.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess having daughters, it's hard for me to want to be in a neighborhood where I know that it's a sexual offender.
The first guy in the video,
Justin.
Yeah. Just watching it. I mean, this makes me terrible. He still seems like he's a little bit strange. Like,
yeah.
He's, you know, so you just wonder, like, is he really?
Yeah.
No.
Our guts may tell us some people are creepy, right? Yeah, go ahead.
I am. I live about a half block from a house of that homeless member. On Grand Avenue, and I lived there for about 8 years. And I get the postcards. People, you know, know those. You know, you get those postcards that have people's pictures. And I used to save them, you know, like thinking, well, you know, if I see one of these people,
mm-hmm.
I don't save them anymore. I also know people that live next door to the house, and they don't have young children, but my level of comfort of that being part of our community has increased, and my fears have decreased. But the other thing I want to say is that, you know, we take steps to protect our kids from a lot of things. And this is one of the things I've been thinking about lately, is like just how, you know, whether it's in church, like, if, you know, I mean, how we screen youth workers and how we, and those things are really important, and we need, we need those things. But you know, it's never perfect. But those kinds of practices can help reduce fear. I mean, you're probably going to talk
about
that.
No, well, it sounds like you're sort of answering our second question.
Yeah,
is what
yeah.
protections do we have in place? You mentioned community notification, so we know. Go ahead.
Well, this is not really an evaluation, but I imagine this is a fairly expensive proposition to have these inmates and the treatment that they get. And if you go back to your discussion about bond and bail,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't it be better to,
well,
I mean, like, wouldn't that money be better suited to take that person who needed $500 and has two kids and a job that she's going to be taken away from for 20 days to put that money towards her bond,
yeah.
Then, and I wonder that. I'm not saying that I think yeah. that, but.
Well, that was one of the points, of which is not really the point of this talk, but one of my points in that video mm-hmm. was it does cost about $250,000 a year to incarcerate someone at McNeil Island. And the treatment providers there are subpar compared. They're not certified in the same way that people in the community are certified to treat sex offenders. And so we're taking supposedly the most dangerous population and we're giving them the worst treatment providers. My point there was that there's no point of having them in the island when they can get better treatment and actually be safer, and it's safer and cheaper to have them treated in the community, although that's not necessarily what this is about. But yeah.
So Minnesota has something very similar. It's not as picturesque, but,
right.
but it, and there was a thing, his name is Thomas Duval. He's been in the news. He had a series of brutal sexual attacks like 30 years ago or 25. Mm-hmm. He got out, he reoffended. And now he's been in for like 20-some years, and he's supposed to get out again. Huge debate about
mm-hmm.
the legality of that. And so my question is, what do the statistics show in terms of number of people who are let out and then reoffend?
We have a lot of that information for you. And anyone else, just before we move on to that, just want to talk about fears or protections. Yeah, go ahead.
I think it's surprising that they got 1 hour per month of counseling.
Yeah. Individual.
Yeah. And, I mean, that was part of it. Yeah.
I think my fear is that they can actually change, and working with families and victims. And I know we have two women DAs that do a lot of the prosecuting in our rural Massachusetts, and they're kind of like throw away the key, and because so far a lot of the, I don't know that they get the appropriate treatment and what that would be like if they did, but so far they do. You know, and working with the kids and the moms and dads, especially the moms of the kids, then you're like,
yeah.
it's hard to have much. It was hard for me to have much empathy.
So fear that someone can't really change.
Right.
Yeah, can't change.
Yeah, can't be rehabbed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't quantify this or qualify it, but I do believe that stranger danger is important. However, it is not just strangers.
Yeah.
What? Who made the decision to go to this model versus a mental health model?
Well, they claim this is a mental health model.
Well, we don't have qualified people treating them.
This can't be constitutional if it's a prison. It's only constitutional if they're getting treatment. So despite all the barbed wire and being on an island and not being able to leave, they, because they have treatment available, they're there for care and treatment, not to be...
Can anybody challenge the level of treatment? Like a Snohomish County?
We have.
Yeah, there has been challenges, and there was one recent, and it, you know, resulted in some change. It resulted in... Well, they have a what do they call that annual report that they do?
The annual review?
No, the
Oh, the Washington Institute of Public Policy?
Yeah. Basically, there is a group that is supposed to assess the quality of the treatment every year, and it's been found to be subpar. Although, I think the last 2 years have actually increased the number of hours available for treatment. They used to get zero, so 1 hour a month. They used to actually get 0 hours a month. So that, you know, that they're supposedly increasing the quality.
There was, just to give you background, we don't want to go into details, but there was a federal injunction against the SEC saying if you don't up your treatment and have some people able to be released, you're not constitutional, you're a prison.
Yeah.
So they put some things in place, but it's still very low.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, up until, I'm not sure, 30 or so years ago, when I had a fairly robust mental hospital system through the country, which then all got started being closed, and people put out on the street, and there was always offenders who were locked in those places, and I'm sure the same questions came up, you know, when, if ever, can they be released, and who decides that, mm-hmm. and what's the risk of reoffense? So this just seems like they retained, for those particular kinds of offenses, this facility and maybe others like it, but it's not, in my mind, much different than the old mental hospital system, which often didn't have qualified people either.
Right. Yeah, I think it's the same. Anyone else aware of, oh, go ahead, sorry.
I don't know how the laws differ from state to state, but where I'm from in Michigan, sex offenders cannot live within a certain distance from schools or whatever. And so at the time I was living on a farm out in the middle of nowhere, I heard about this young man. I had a family, and he needed to take the classes, and he was also trying to hold down a job. So I'm sure it wasn't the most popular decision I ever made with the extended family, but I let him come and stay. They didn't really need to worry, because by the time he put in a day's work and then went to all the classes, he was really only sleeping there anyway. I mean, it was very rigorous what he went through. But the fear is that he was one of the friendliest, most gregarious young men. He was not creepy, really, in any way. And I've known people who tried to help those who were coming out of jail. And, for instance, if they weren't supposed to be on the computer, they just had very devious ways of getting, you know, a chance to use a computer and whatever, and went back to jail. And I think the recidivism is pretty high, so I don't know. But one protection is making sure that they can't rent or buy close to parks, schools.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, so that's what zones without registered sex offenders are. So
I just bought a condo in the Minneapolis area, and when I was signing the papers for it, three times in that paper it said, call this number to assure that there were no sex offenders living in the area, or if you wanted to know if there were any. I had never seen that before. Of course, the last time I bought a house was, you know, 92.
So they're really, they're not just doing community notification, but they're really advertising, you know, the public's ability to know where sex offenders are living.
Yeah. I think a lot of times, you know, we don't acknowledge the degree to which, you know, this exists even in our own, you know, faith communities. And there was an example, I won't say who or where, but it was in Washington State. We're in a church. A prominent person in the church had a sexual relationship with a woman in the church who's 12, and a, you know, a girl. And, you know, and we're talking, you know, spouse worked for the church, WLCA, all this stuff, went to jail. And I remember being on the dock to come up from Lady Lake, and they were coming up to Holden. It was, you know, probably like 3 or 4 years later, and just awareness of my own, like, geez, out in public. I mean, I was so surprised at my own reaction of kind of like, I mean, probably if he'd been a treasurer and embezzled church funds, I think I would have had a different reaction. You know, like I was just aware of my own. You know, I was kind of like, you know, and I knew this person. But even though I say now, I'm, you know, this is you know, maybe 20 years ago, maybe not that long ago, but I'm aware now of being more comfortable living next to sex offenders. I don't know, you know, but I was sure aware of how this person had become a pariah to me in a way that was beyond other kind of criminal action that I know that people have done. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I listened to a man try to find a place to live. He was a sex offender out of jail, and every call he made, he had to tell them that he was a registered sex offender, and he was turned down every time.
Sure.
You can't live here, you can't live here. And my concern is, if they're nowhere, where are they?
And yes, I think that is a very important point. Wouldn't we rather have them in homes in places where we know where they are, we know that they're safe and their basic needs are being met, than living under bridges.
Mm-hmm.
That's what increases risk.
Oh, yeah, right.
Is Megan's Law a California law or a federal law?
Megan's Law?
I think that is the thing that started the federal civil code.
So, like, in California, sex shop vendors, I mean, it's all on the internet, you can look it up, you can see where they live. And so, like, in my school, I had this wonderful family, four kids, churchgoers, whose father, when he was 17, committed some very brief offense with a 14-year-old. This was before Megan's Law went into effect. He paid for his crime in whatever way he had to. And then later, so he thought, okay, this is all behind me. Then Megan's Law went into effect, and which he never foresaw, of course. So now it's, you know, his house has got this red dot on the map. And so other parents in my school, when I had the third kid, it never came up with reverse too. But the third one, other parents went berserk. They were warning the other parents, don't let your kids play with these kids or go over to their house. Mm-hmm. And then they started this big, I mean, like witch hunt kind of thing to not allow him to drop his children off at school, nor come to school performances or anything. And he never came to volunteer in the school or field trips or anything like that anyway. But he couldn't even then come to, like, our school circus or something where there's all these other adults. So basically, it was like a life sentence for someone who other people in the same situation had their records expunged, but you can't do that unless the judge is with him. You go to the same judge, and his judge had died. And so something he did when he was 17, 20 years later, he had a perfectly clean record. He was really wrecking his life, the life of his kids. It is like a life sentence. And if a murderer was in our community, they could drop their kids off to school. Yeah. They could come to performances, but it's that particular.
They don't have to register or be shown on the internet where a murderer lives.
Right. So let's actually take a moment. We have some research that shows us actually the real recidivism or reoffense rates. And this is from the Department of Justice. This is 1994, so it's somewhat dated. But basically, it showed a reoffense rate with a new sex offense of 3.5%, which is incredibly low. Especially
since 1994, it's actually gone down. It's probably at 2.7%.
Yeah.
So it's not what you see on TV and what you hear in the news and the common knowledge of people that sex offenders are always reoffend.
And compare that to, I don't know if you guys were here yesterday, but compare that to some of the statistics we discussed yesterday about the overall, or maybe that was the first day, the overall reoffense rate for people in the United States of general criminality was 76%.
Yeah.
So when you think about, like, you know, the people who are reoffending are the drug and the property and the, you know, those sort of crimes, it's not the sex offenders.
Hmm.
The next slide actually shows 94 to 98, so it's a little bit more, and focuses specifically on child sex offenders, and it showed the reoffense rate for child people who offend against children to be even lower.
If somebody is convicted of a child offense and that they are sentenced to whatever amount of jail time, do they get counseling in that program, or only if they're sent to this other place do they get some type of support?
It depends on the length of their sentence and where they're sent to be. But there is a prison-based sex offender.
So that 2.3%, some may have had some work, some counseling, or whatever, and some may not have?
That's correct.
Correct.
I'm wondering how comes so often in the paper where we see it posted, they'll say most likely to reoffend, or they have those explanations of
where they rate the risk of reoffense.
So very often it's so very high, likely to reoffend, doesn't quite.
But they're rating them in that 2.7% within the.
Yeah, but how come there's so many of them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is one of the problems, is that we have a lot of misinformation about what the
even
true...
Even though they're in the paper. Is that because they haven't gone to classes or something?
No, what they do is they... the law that puts people on the island makes requires a determination that that person is more than 50% likely to reoffend.
Right.
And so, the, so, but that is, I think, based on bad research. Mm. And I think the numbers that you're seeing are the ones that it's based on very bad research, very bad samples that are actually old before we had a lot of these protections that
right.
we were just discussing, and we'll discuss a little
bit
more.
And
I think,
anyway, you know, so I think if there's information to on the internet, I suppose.
Yeah.
I haven't really checked on that because I have little kids anymore.
Yeah, I mean, this was Washington State, too. The other one is Department of Justice. And this one is this, yeah, the sex offender sentencing guidelines. So this is a government, this isn't the psychologist study or, you know, this is a government study who tracks all of the sex offenders that are released from their facilities. So I think that this is very reliable data.
Can you clarify that a little bit? Is that 94 to 98, is that over what period of time later? Is that 2.3% within those 4 years had a citizen? Or so if they were released in 94 by 98, 2.3%?
I think it's...
Or they released over that 4 year period and then they looked over 10 years later? I think
yeah, so
that's
a good question.
I believe that it's... Offenders released 94 by 98 or within it's usually approximately a 5 year window. But what we know from the research, and again, we don't want to get too much into it, but the longer you remain in the community offense free, your risk actually decreases, not increases. So the 10 year rates are even lower. And we don't really, I think we have maybe some 15 or 20 year data that in some of the research that we've read, but
we try to just look at peer-reviewed research that are in journals that are accredited to an association, and they go through a rigorous process, because otherwise you don't know exactly how this research was put out there, who's saying this, and whether it has any validity. Even the peer-reviewed research is going to have opposition to it. You have to read it all to get a true idea.
This is another one. We were talking about stranger danger. And what this shows is sex offenses against children, all sex offenses against children, and only 6.7% were actually perpetrated by a stranger. The rest were family, friends, or family members or friends of family. So that really, I think, highlights the point that we do not need to fear the stranger, you know? I mean, if we are to be concerned about anyone, it is, you know, the people that we know.
It's kind of a terrible thought that really, and of course you have healthy fear about strangers, in a general sense. But if you're really looking at the statistics, it's not the, you know, scary person you don't know. It's being sure the people who you have in contact with your children are, you know, safe.
Yeah.
I hesitate to bring this up because you had some wonderful statistics about recidivism, no, it was incarceration versus per 100,000 residents versus the 13 original countries in NATO,
mm-hmm.
and how we were off the chart, literally off the chart. Are there any similar studies about sex offenders in the United States and
that's a good question. I don't really know. I mean, I think the thing that was driving that chart and those statistics that showed the U.S. Mass incarceration rate was really crimes other than the sex.
I know.
Yeah.
You know, we have seen studies like that. I don't have them at the top of my head right now.
Yeah.
But certainly a lot of studies about recidivism have come from other countries, and we've read, and there's been... a lot of different studies.
There's been a lot of...
New
Zealand and Canada.
Canada, a lot of research in Canada.
I think there was another European study, too. I can't remember.
That's a good question. I just don't have those numbers.
Yeah. Go ahead.
You said that there's 2.3% was the recidivism rate. Is the recidivism rate less on the people who go to McNeil Island and get that versus people that stay in the community or vice versa?
I mean, I think the answer, we don't have, I mean, I think the answer has to be yes. we have had nobody that our offices represented reoffend once they were released from the island. I think we know one.
Yeah. I think the Washington State Institute of Public Policy said 0.08 or something like that from the island on the study they did.
So I want to sort of turn the focus back to the experience that, given that sex offenders are being released into our community, whether it's from McNeil Island or directly from prison, what is our Christian response now that we sort of have some information about the true reoffense rate? And one of the things that I think is also important to look at is these are the number of registered sex offenders and sex offenders, so also the and sex offenders killed or murdered. And one of the things that I think has driven that increase is more fear about sex offenders and people. I mean, there was a terrible case over in Port Angeles a few years ago where a registered sex offender was just released and someone came and murdered him in his home. And it's because people are afraid and they're angry that someone who harmed a child or harmed an adult in a very brutal way would be released. It's funny, though, that people aren't tracking murderers and killing them. So, I mean, I think that we have to recognize that this is a different sort of emotionality that we're dealing with.
Well, and what you said, they're public now. Yeah, everybody knows where they live, so it's easier.
Yeah.
Last year we tried to open this, we worked with some clients going into this halfway house, and it had to keep getting delayed because people were graffitiing the house before it could open.
So actually someone tried to set it on fire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is this national or Washington State? What is this?
This is national, I believe. So, I mean, it's less than 80 sex offenders across the United States, but still, I mean, why should 80 sex offenders be murdered simply because of their status?
Yeah. This is not a study, this is anecdotal, but my husband and I lived in Portsmouth, Virginia, Portsmouth, Pennsylvania, and again, when we bought the house, this all popped up, and within about an 8-block radius, there were 17 registered sex offenders, and my husband's a minister, and we got to know a lot of the neighbors, and we said, you know, our churches need to be doing something about talk, because they were, you know, they've been released, and they were not in a program that we knew of anyway. And so we talked to the one that we knew the best, because he lived 2 doors down from us, and we ended up getting churches, different denominations, to get together and meet the sex offenders and ask them if there was anything that we could do to help. And if whatever it might be, we ended up in the neighborhood, we ended up doing a halfway house. We had problems too getting it started, and it took about 3 years. But eventually, we had 10 men that were living in one of these Victorian old homes. And we had members from the congregation that were attorneys or social workers or counselors. And it was a vital program. And we lived in there for 10 years. We never saw, out of the 17 men, we never saw a reoffender. And out of the other thing is, this is, like I said, it's anecdotal. It's not, you know, a study, but out of all of those 17 men, they all had been abused.
Yeah.
We were talking about that right before, and we think 100% of our clients that we've represented, we couldn't think of one that hadn't been abused.
Right.
Yeah. That's great about your congregation. I know, Terry, you and your congregation also had similar.
Yeah, so I was serving at an Episcopal church in Marysville, Washington, and I got a call from a man one day, and so I met him for coffee, and so we went out and met for coffee. And he said that his parole officer had said that he could consider becoming part of a congregation, and would I be willing to work with him? Would our congregation be willing to work with him? And so I even had to sign a piece of paper that said that was okay, that he had come to me and that we had considered it. So I, you know, I did contact the bishop and let him know what was happening a little bit and talk about that. We sort of arranged in a series of negotiations with this man and the parole officer, like some of the boundaries that would be happening. So in other words, he was to come to the parking lot pretty close to worship time. And then to come and always stay upstairs and not to be downstairs, not to be in a room alone. That as soon as the sanctuary was kind of, you know, getting emptied out, to please come out and be up in the narthex where I could see him at least for a while. And then we had lots of pastoral conversations asking him about what kind of work he was doing internally on this. And I really sensed that he was not only doing the work, but he wanted to do the work. And then he began to share with me like his struggles with his job, because his supervisor knew of his status and was verbally and otherwise abusive to him, and knew that he had the power over him because it'd be hard for him to find another job. So we did a lot of like work around that. And then when he got his master's degree in business, I was very pleased to be invited to show up and celebrate his accomplishment. And so we did tell two members of the Congregation Council of the Vestry and the Episcopal Church about it. And then eventually we felt so good about how he was around the facility and with everyone. Some of those things were relaxed a little bit. And we actually invited him to be on the church council, which he turned down. He says that he wasn't ready for that kind of stress, which I commended him on. He said, great job. You know? Yeah. So anyway, I'm so proud of him.
So there's actually, thank you so much, there's actually research that, so these are not just anecdotal, you know, people don't reoffend because you knew 17 and you worked with them, or Terry worked with the member. There's actually research to support the idea that when people have strong community support networks, they don't reoffend. But before we kind of go back to that, I think we should probably look and see and just discuss some of the challenges that sex offenders face upon the release. So it's more than just like the possibility of being murdered. That's probably even though I think that's
more rare.
But I mean, we've heard some of these challenges, and as we're thinking about what our Christian response might be. Go ahead.
Oh, I just have a question about Justin and what happened to him when he was 13, and did he get treatment then, and how that could have ended probably when he was 13. And this happens a lot with teenage boys that are young kids, 12, 14.
So Justin struggled with his own sexuality. He's an adult gay man now. Okay. He has a committed relationship with another adult gay man who is not at McNeil Island. He was abused brutally. I won't go into the graphic details, but he actually testified about it in his trial that Judge Lorman presided over, and it's shocking what he endured, and I think people, that just messes with your idea of what it means to show affection and love to people. And you know, he then started to abuse his siblings. He was actually removed from his home and put into foster care, and a group home. I think not foster care with the family, but like a group home, and that's not. Hasn't historically shown to be a very
good tree.
You know, very good model for rehabilitation. And then essentially he kind of snowballed from there, so he never really got meaningful treatment until he was an adult. I think that there's something to say about early interventions, and one of the earliest interventions could have been when he reported his own abuse to his mother. He would have been believed and gotten treatment at that time, instead of been told to, you know, forget about it, or been told that it, you know, maybe it didn't happen or something.
Do you have any statistics about how safe it is for child molesters or whatever when they're in jail, if they're not in a program like that island, but where they're just sent in with the general jail population? I've heard that they really treated
very violently by the other prisoners?
We don't know the statistics offhand, but yeah, that's true. Everybody who in prison who has a sex offense, especially against a child, is treated as a very lowest of the low, is at risk for rape, for being beat up, for being killed. That's very...
Yeah, I mean, many of our clients who are convicted, so they're still in their criminal phase of their punishment, and you know they want their, you know, they don't want any paperwork showing, you know, when they go off to prison showing what they're convicted of or something.
Yeah, please don't send me anything.
Yeah, I think pretty much the prisons know that this is a problem and try once they get to the prison. So this is still a problem while they're in the jail with a variety of populations of people. But once they get to prison, I think they are housed with other sex offenders to try to reduce that.
But of course, it's not like you go to McNeil Island instead of prison. It's after you've served your prison sentence that you go to McNeil Island if you're committed.
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, looking at your statistics, that the probability of somebody who's been through the program and released is going to reoffend is teeny weeny, but just listening to all of our reactions and reservations to as how far we can trust these people in our community and we need to watch our kids is so out of line with that. I mean, the guy down the street who got drunk and killed your neighbor's teenager is more likely to reoffend than these people, and yet we wouldn't have the same, you know, concern.
Or an unknown acquaintance or a family member.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
it's something about sex, the fact that it involves sex, you know, people lose their rational ability to.
So we'll get to some of the research, but these are kind of some of the barriers. I know a lot of us talked about housing. It's really difficult for sex offenders to find housing, and then the idea that the alternative is that they live in this very risky situation of under a bridge or, you know, in a park somewhere. Of course, we've heard stories about it's difficult to get jobs because you do have to disclose your status.
And one cause of reoffense is isolation, depression, loneliness. Those all are known factors for reoffense. So if we can keep those from happening, you can lower your reoffense rate.
So this is just from Psychology Today, but they talk about the best approach is a collaborative approach that where people are working together, have a treatment provider, you know, find employers. There are employers out there, wonderful people who have said, you know what, I own my own business. I will employ sex offenders, you know, and because I see that to be a huge need and a huge way that I can contribute to community safety as well. So the model that has actually been, this is a faith-based model. It was basically developed by a Canadian Mennonite pastor, and it's called Circles of Support and Accountability, or COSA. And here, you can just read here, but it basically outlines a restorative approach to risk management for high-risk sex offenders. Ex-offenders, and using professionally facilitated volunteerism. We could all be in someone's COSA. And basically, there's a core member, and here, actually, the next slide, but that kind of demonstrates that a little bit better, but here we go. But basically, the more people we have around us who know about our past but are also willing to bring us into their community, the safer everybody is. And this is pretty... So we're talking, again, about a low recidivism rate, somewhere between 2 and 3%. And when people had a COSA, that dropped 83% of that two to 3%. So we're talking almost no reoffense for someone who's involved in a COSA. So that's pretty impactful. And one of the ways I know people have been, you know, working, you know, in addition to helping welcome people with conditions and with supervision, but into their churches and different organizations like that. I know that there's a need for people just to sort of be their ambassadors in the community, a friend of my mom's who, and mine, from church, volunteered to drive a sex offender that I represented, drive him to his treatment and that kind of stuff, and just help him out that way, and be a support person for him. So this is actually, it seems scary, but this is a way we can actually all get involved. And we, if you're interested, we can certainly plug you in.
We often, when somebody is being released, Rachel or another person, or Sonia, myself, we'll get on the phone and call congregations to see who might be willing to let one of our clients come into their congregation and try to set that up. And sometimes it's really difficult to find a congregation that will.
Yeah, maybe it's surprising, maybe it's not surprising, but I mean, I will call pastors and say, I have a client, he is a believer, this has been part of his, that has become part of his, I guess, safety measures that he's put in place through his treatment program. It's not the only one. But he wants to be part of a faith community. When he gets out, can he come to your community and click, or just not call us back? I mean, I rarely, and it's not even the offender themselves calling, it's me, So,
I was curious about, we've been talking about pretty hardcore offenders, sex offenders, but what about the, 19-year-olds that go on a date and the girl says she's 18 and oops, she's not, and then all of a sudden he's registering as a sex offender. What kind of percentage is that? Is that a fairly high percentage?
Of the people convicted of those sorts of offenses?
Yeah.
So I'm not sure.
Yeah.
We really wanted to focus in this presentation on the ones that are the least forgivable,
okay.
Right?
Okay.
I mean, we can understand that, and I think it's easy comparatively for us to welcome that person back into the fold of our communities. It is not easy to welcome these guys in. So the goal of the COSA, the Circle of Support and Accountability, is rehumanization and remoralization. We want these offenders, maybe they never were properly socialized, given their family backgrounds, or we want them to have our values, which is, of course, not to hurt people. And so these are just some of the ways. It's not simply the absence of further offending, although that's the primary goal, right? We also want people to live pro-social, productive lives and have intimate relationships, stable employment, and positive community ties. And those are going to be the things that says, okay, this person, we're not just keeping that behavior at bay, but we're actually encouraging good behavior. And the results are compelling. And this is kind of what Jennifer was talking about addressing the offender's need for humanity, loneliness, or positive relationships has a strong impact. So it's not easy. This is just our last sort of thought on this issue, and then we'd love to hear from you more. Seems easy when we talk about it in here and we're not actually sitting next to a sex offender that we know of. We have to have compassion. And I think one of the things as Christians is we all believe in change, or the capacity for change, and that doesn't just apply to us. If Jesus can love them, so can we. Any questions?
Yeah. I think we have to believe that people are redeemable.
Yeah.
And that as a Christian community, if we really believe in redemption for some, we have to believe in it for all. And know that these people can be redeemed and that God loves them. So.
Go ahead. Can you notice the difference in the way sentences are given to people with this kind of problem, depending upon their status, for instance, their wealth. I'm thinking of a guy in our church. It's a big church, so we probably got more than one situation, but this guy is extremely wealthy. He took his retired, he took his computer into the repair, and they found all this damning evidence. His name was never in the paper, and he didn't go to jail. And he really chafed at the church's procedure, like Terry had said. It wasn't anywhere near rigorous as what Terry was talking about, but he was supposed to kind of, well, his wife was a nurse, and she said she'd be responsible, you know, that he stayed out of trouble. Anyway, I kind of took offense at the way that he never acted sorry for anything, and he just bought his way out of the whole thing. And then when they didn't like the way the community was making him jump through a couple hoops at church, they just moved away. But I think I just was so sure that if it had been somebody who'd been kind of on the fringes.
I think it all works together. I think that poverty is always an issue in the criminal justice system, how people are treated. Implicit bias is always an issue.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know without knowing the evidence of that case or you know maybe what the offense was plea bargained to. It's hard to say, but I mean I think for the purposes of sort of thinking about what our response should be, we also have to recognize that like you know someone has to want to change too. So it doesn't maybe sound like
well his job. As a retired person, he was a consultant to help really big corporations skirt the environmental laws. So he was
so maybe he's just a bad guy.
Maybe you should have prosecuted him.
Yeah. Any other thoughts? Go ahead.
No, we're just hitting the Me Too movement, so it's still very difficult to report sexual abuse of any kind. But also knowing that so many people were abused as children, are they implementing any treatment for kids that do report so that hopefully they don't become offenders as adults?
I don't know specifically. We don't have as much contact with the people who are reporting, obviously. It does seem like it's being talked about more, and that there's more resources for victims.
We don't really meet our clients who all of them are victims until they've also become offenders.
Yeah,
vendors,
yeah.
So,
yeah, we get them
you know.
Way on the backside of things.
Well, I know
that's really important. Yeah,
I know working with like a 4-year-old when I was coordinating mental health services, and she'd been brutally raped many times, and they wanted to end her services because they thought they were going on too long. I mean, because she's on medic. I mean, it was. So once again, yes, if you have private funds, but it's a battle. I mean, she did fortunately end up with good services, but.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, even the kids that haven't been sexually abused, but have just been maybe verbally or physically abused, we don't provide help for them. It's all dependent on the parents or the grandparents or a church group. Or, I mean, it's not like, okay, this got turned in and somebody got prosecuted. You know, we don't get automatic good.
We put all our money towards the after effects, the crime, the
incarceration.
When all that, I always think that. If all that money could be put into the abused children, to education, would we need all the money on the other side? It's definitely an issue.
Well, we certainly don't want to cut this off, but it's 7:05, and so we actually figured out how to play that video that we promised you yesterday.
Oh, if anyone
wants to see that.
Feel free to leave.
Feel free to leave. But I want everyone who wanted to see that to have that chance. So
We would like to thank you for engaging in this topic and talking.
So if anyone wants to talk about this further, we're happy to do that. Later, we'll be around all night. So, okay. So here is Chad and Kevin Barber. Again, they were the ones who had the shootout over the stolen chainsaws.
Yeah, just some people are leaving.
Done a lot of things for me, helped me whenever I needed it, taken me to and supported me through every sporting event, anything I chose to do in life.
I've known Kevin since, well, we got married in 1985, so it's been a long time. It's always a joke in our family, what's he talking about now, where is he now, if we go shopping or anywhere we go, because he makes friends just everywhere we go. It's annoying to go to Costco because he's just off talking to somebody about something he tried last time he was there. And he just loves to talk to people. He's very kind soul. He's just a good guy.
I would describe Chad as, he's always been a woodsman. It's all about hunting, fishing, being in the woods. That's why he chose the profession that he is as far as timber cutter. He cares about people. If he sees somebody on the side of the road, he'll stop and help. He will change a tire. He will give somebody a ride. He does it all the time.
He's just solid. He's nice. He's always been a very trustworthy son. I'm pretty amazed at his can-do-itness when it comes to making something, building something, fixing motors. He just can. And I love that about him. I admire him.
I know Chad and Kevin because my son, Caden, Chad is the father of Caden, and Kevin is the papa.
My name is Caden, and my age is 8. I love my papa and my dad this much.
I have known Chad since he was a little boy. I've known Kevin for 30 years now. We coach baseball together. I would say that Kevin and Chad both are very compassionate and caring.
I know Kevin and Chad because basically family, brother and dad is what I would call them. They give you the shirt off their back and their last meal just to help somebody out.
They'll drop what they're doing to go help some people that need it. Doesn't matter what time of the day or night.
They are there for Caden anytime. I can call them if I need anything. Something happened to my car, something at my house, just having a bad day.
The charity work that they had done for me personally, helping my mom change out the windows in her house and putting a new roof on the house. I mean, when people can't afford those things, Kevin and Chad, those guys were there to help without pay.
The day of the slide in Oso, we both spent day after day out there. Chad actually used a week of his vacation time. We just packed up our chainsaws and our backpacks with everything we could put in them, our tools. And
they heard that people needed help. They dropped what they were doing, and they were up there, spent every single day in the mud, getting the roads built so that the heavy equipment could get in and start searching for people.
My family is the type where we'll go out of our way to do anything for anybody. My parents are very welcoming to anybody.
We do a lot of things with our community, kids, coaching. I've always worked in the school district.
Between Chad and I, we both coach Little League.
My roles as a coach was not only to teach kids the basics of the sports, but it was also to teach them sportsmanship. I enjoy helping kids learn new things. Letting them aspire to be better kids and more active.
I wouldn't be who I am today if Kevin didn't teach me how to really be a man or even take care of my responsibilities.
Kevin really had a soft heart because he came from not the greatest
childhood.
Beginning in the fourth grade, my parents were incarcerated, and my foster parent or my legal guardian wasn't the best situation for me to be in. And then I met Jared, their other son. And one of the first times I ever came over to their house, and Jeannie and Kevin heard my story and what I was going through, almost immediately they just kind of took me in.
Sean lived here for about 6 years. Is that this right here? That's Sean. That's our son, Jared Christian.
Even before my parents were incarcerated, they just weren't good parents. My dad was a drug dealer. My mom was a drug user. I could do whatever I wanted at any time growing up. And then when I moved in to Jeannie and Kevin's place, I actually had rules. They taught me even to take a shower every night, the little things, brush my teeth every day. To see the structure of a family, it really impacted me.
We went for a long show. We had to watch his parents sign their rights away.
I've been through a lot in my life. I would have gone through a lot more if it wasn't for them. I'm not the only person either that would call them mom or dad. There are other people who they've taken in and they've helped, whether it be just a couple months or a year.
Before my 22nd birthday, he took his life.
He passed away on September 23rd. So this September will be 8 years. It could have been yesterday. That's why it took us so long to do anything on the front porch, because that's what we found.
That's been devastating for our family. It's made us become dependent on each other and closer, because Jeff was always the I moved out when I was 17. He's always been independent. And now, and then he moved closer, and then we had him come back here after this thing happened.
It was devastating, to say the least.
It was horrible. I really, Kevin would die. He had, like, really high blood pressure. He didn't eat. He didn't sleep. Chad was, he's in more times than just the glue. Although we had always worried about the impact that losing his brother was to him, I think he's more concerned about the impact for us. He's the one that finally told us, he said, you have to take Jared out of your head and put him in your heart, otherwise you're not going to make it. That was pretty profound for me. I grabbed that. Like a lifeline.
Going through this, I think that it's really brought the three of them left, Jeannie and Kevin and Chad, obviously brought them closer together. The family has always been so tight, so close. The bond is amazing to watch.
It devastated our family. And then we just started getting close again. Started doing things intentionally to try to get back together. Of course, Caden was in the picture. Just the four of us together is our family. It's how our new family is, with a big gaping hole.
We talk about it a lot.
Since our son passed away, just at that time, Caden was plugged in. It was that piece of life and joy that Kevin was able to attach to. And it saved him.
We kind of filled in a void, which I think helped us get through a lot of really, really hard times after we lost Jared.
Have Caden in my life after my brother passed brought a lot more joy.
He's always had this hope because he shares his room with what was Uncle Jared's
room. Where are you in the bed?
Chad. It really breaks my heart that his brother Jared's not here to see what an amazing dad he really is. He's a good-hearted, caring, loving father. He's the same kind of dad that Kevin is.
My son Caden's probably one of the smartest 8-year-olds I've ever known. He's very witty, very intelligent.
It's been awesome to watch him unfold and the kind of dad that he is.
Being a dad is one of the greatest things that's ever happened. I get to experience new things with him and teach him things that I care about.
most fun thing we did together is writing and basketball.
Chad takes Caden on adventures up in the woods. They ride their quads. They go fishing and swimming in the river, and they do so much stuff all the time.
He's involved in everything Caden does, from school to motorcycles to fishing. He includes him in everything that he does.
He holds his son accountable for everything. I mean, he just likes him to do his chores. He likes him to make sure he's read, done his homework.
Caden is here all but Tuesday night and Friday nights.
The relationship with Caden, with his papa, Kevin, and his father, Chad, this is very strong.
I feel great about my papa and daddy. They taught me how to play basketball, ride a bicycle, and to do fishing, and to shoot a bow and arrow. My favorite thing we do is motocross.
I grew up racing motocross my whole life, so that's something we truly share together.
Chad and Kevin are out on that track. Doesn't matter if it's raining or if it's sunny. They're out there cheering him on, and they're teaching him new things. They give him tips and pointers about after the practice what he could have done or what he did great. They don't put him down. They're very encouraging. They're always there for him.
Concealed weapons permits, and every time I was in public, I carried. The whole thing only took 15 seconds. I can't even tell you what was going through my mind at the time, other than I already lost one son, and all I'm thinking is that my son's going to die. And I just reacted. I lay face down in the parking lot for a couple of hours. I can remember asking about the guy that I shot. I must have asked about him, I don't know how many times, but I want to know if he was okay.
The way it rolled out is just, it was devastating to both of them.
Hindsight, I can see lots of things I did wrong that day. I should never went there unless I was with the sheriff to begin with.
I wish every day that I could go back in time and take it back. It was very, very sad somebody got hurt.
I know lots of people that carry. I know lots of people that have concealed weapons permits. And when I see somebody that's carrying, whether it's open carry or they're concealed and I know they have it, I tell them what happened to me. I tell them exactly how it impacted my family. Whether I'm right or wrong, when this all happens, it's going to impact your family one way or another. Not to mention the impact it has on the other person. I didn't go anywhere intentionally hurting anybody that day, but I know his family suffered. I know that he suffered.
Kevin and Chad have shed more than one tear over the whole thing, and I feel horrible. I can't speak for them, but I think that if they had it to do over again, they wouldn't have had a firearm on their person. They have a whole different outlook on the firearm in itself, and they're very remorseful that it just like 15 seconds in their life, this unfolded, and it changed three men's lives. I don't know the other gentleman. We would have loved to have reached out to him and told him that we're sorry he was injured and we feel horrible. I mean, no one wants this to happen.
I feel sad for the family, the other family, and I know they do too. They feel bad about this. In my heart, I know that Kevin and Chad honestly feel remorse for this. They know they've done wrong. They want to make it right. This is not in their character to have done something like this.
They would be wonderful to talk to other people about, are you sure you want to carry that gun?
They want to be able to talk to other people to try to give people the information they need to think before they react so this kind of thing doesn't happen again.
This has impacted every aspect of our life.
This has been two long years of stress. It's taken a huge toll on us financially, emotionally, physically. There is no no area that it hasn't impacted in our lives.
My dad lost his job, and I also lost my job. I had to seek other work. I had to buy all new saws to go to work.
Because of all this, obviously I lost my income overnight. We're buying in the house. A lot of challenges.
Yeah.
So we're
well, we had a lot of play toys and things that, you know, we just had no problem. Just
things
sell
and replace things.
Try to make ends meet, but I'm a little stressed out about how I'm going to do it for this one.
Incarceration is going to impact my family and my son in a huge way because it's going to leave my mom all by herself, and it's going to leave my son without anybody to show him new things and teach him things. It's not going to be easy for him, especially being 8 and not having a father around.
Myself and Chad are the only men in his life.
I can't ever feel Chad and Kevin's shoes where Kevin's concerned. I mean, Kate and I are close, but I'm not Kevin and I'm not his dad.
It's going to be absolutely just destructive if Chad were to leave.
When a parent of a very young child becomes incarcerated, it can have a very severe impact on that child's emotional well-being. Often what happens is children experience the loss or the separation from that parent as though that parent has been lost to them. So grief, loss, loneliness, feelings of fear or anxiety can be experienced also.
I'm not even sure how it's going to affect Kaden. He might completely shut down, and that's what I'm really worried about, because he does rely on them a lot.
How's he going to get to school every day? How's his schedule going to be affected? Is he going to have to start getting up at 4 in the morning to go to school at 9 o'clock so he can ride with somebody else? I just don't know how that's going to work, and I have all these scenarios running through my mind all the time.
He's going to be very heartbroken because his whole world is going to completely change.
For me, the biggest thing is trying to figure out how my family is going to get by.
I've never not been with my family, so I don't know how that's going to feel. I've been with him for 35 years. I can't even imagine how I'd be able to.
Everybody depends on me. So how do you plan to be gone for 3 years? It's not like I'm going camping for a week. You know, wintertime, we heat our little house with wood. My wife's not going to get out and cut 10 cords of wood.
I am thinking if the washing machine breaks down, or my car, or, you know, the refrigerator's old, Kevin. What if? And he always fixes everything, he makes everything good, and I just make all those sort of things too. You know, if I keep the lights on.
Who's going to provide the money for the house payment? My wife's a school bus driver, she doesn't make any money. There's insurance, there's fuel, there's food, there's everything.
I'm at a loss. I don't really know how I'm going to do it on my own. But I'm going to try not to. I don't know. I don't know how it all comes
in. We'll probably lose the house if we don't get it sold. They'll probably foreclose. So hopefully she'll be able to get it, Jeannie will be able to get it sold before that happens, which is going to put a huge burden on her because she's going to have to be the one to move 23 years worth of living here. 23 years, you collect a lot of stuff. And so, there's some hard times down, that's for sure. I'll have the easy part of it. She'll have the hard part of it. And that really bothers me. We've already been through hell because of this, because of my actions, because of what I did. There's a lot of people that depend on me. It's just going to be really, really hard. Just not to be able to help, not to be able to, you know, birthdays and Christmas and all that. We've already suffered it. A loss. So we're already missing something close.
So we all survived through it, and literally, I'm just kind of okay. I'm afraid people could be nice. I just don't want to lose my. I don't want them to lose my.
If I could stay with my family. and not be incarcerated, I'd be able to help support my family and be there for my son to grow up.
But it's always best to start with an approach of preventing the incarceration from happening if possible. And so if public safety and other issues can be assured with the parent parenting in the community, those things should be considered, because that child is going to benefit more from having that relationship continue undisrupted than if it's disrupted.
To the public, they are not dangerous people at all. That's not their nature.
Without thinking about what this is going to do.
If we can prevent unnecessary separation, then those children do not have to go through the experience of the loss, the grief, the sudden separation, and the lack of developing that secure bond and attachment with that parent that might occur if their parent were separated because of incarceration.
Unfortunately, the barbers are in prison for 3.5 years.
They killed the person.
No.
No.
It turns out it probably was not the person. It was a mistake.
Did Rachel, the guy that they shot?
Yeah, thank you guys.
The guy that got shot, did he die?
No, he was significantly injured, but he did not die. He's fully recovered, so. Would someone mind grabbing the lights over there so no one trips?
Thank you.
Thanks.